Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, one U.S. bishop weighs in on the new English translation of the Roman Missal. And he's alive to tell his story today, thanks to groundbreaking stem cell therapy using adult stem cells. We talk to this former patient and to the doctor who saved his life. But first, Pope Benedict XVI concluded his series of catecheses on the Psalms during his general audience Wednesday, part of his wider cycle on the Christian School of Prayer. Emma McCarthy reports.
A particularly important messianic text in church tradition, Psalm 110, says Pope Benedict, tells us, yes, there is much evil in the world, and that there is also an ongoing battle between good and evil, and evil seems to be stronger. However, the Lord, our true King and Priest, Christ, is stronger still, because he fights with the power of God, and despite all those things which make us doubt a positive outcome for history, Christ wins. And good wins. Love wins. Never hatred. Twenty 20,000 pilgrims and visitors filled St. Peter's Square for the Wednesday audience. Pope Benedict began by tracing the history of this psalm, one of the famous royal psalms, originally linked to the enthronement of a Davidic monarch.
The Church reads this psalm as a prophecy of Christ, the Messianic King and Eternal Priest, risen from the dead and seated at the right hand of the Father. St. Peter, in his speech on the day of Pentecost, applies his words to the Lord's victory over death and his exaltation in glory. From ancient times, this mysterious third verse of the psalm has been interpreted as a reference to the king's divine sonship, while the fourth verse speaks of him as a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. The letter of the Hebrew to the Hebrew specifically applies this imagery to Christ, the Son of God and our perfect High Priest, who lives eternally to make intercession for all those who through him approach the Father.
In comments in Italian, Pope Benedict noted at the end of the psalm is the triumphant King who, supported by the Lord, scatters his enemies and judges the nations. And finally, the Holy Father greeted all of the pilgrims and visitors present in St. Peter's Square in various languages, including English.
Upon all English-speaking pilgrims present, especially those from Great Britain, Denmark, Norway, Japan, Canada and the United States, I know God's blessings of joy and peace.
It was Pope Benedict's final public appointment ahead of his departure this Friday for Benin, Africa. I'm Emer McCarthy.
Are Catholics in the United States preparing for the introduction of the new English translation of the Roman Missal for their Sunday liturgies? The new translation formally replaces the old translation as of the first Sunday of Advent, November 27th. Though welcomed by many, it hasn't lacked its critics. Well, Bishop Thomas Tobin of Providence, Rhode Island, here in Rome for the ad limina visit of U.S. bishops, spoke to Emer McCarthy about how he plans to introduce his Catholic parishioners to the new Missal.
Of course, for Catholics, nothing is more important than the celebration of the liturgy, the celebration of the Holy Mass. So anytime there are changes in the liturgy, in the Mass, it is an issue that affects people very deeply, and sometimes, as you say, very emotionally. We've been involved in our diocese in a long process now that has lasted almost a year, I suppose, of preparing people for the changes in the Roman Missal. Again, through classes and through information, our diocesan newspaper and websites, through seminars for almost every segment of the church, beginning, of course, with the priests, because the changes in the Missal will have as more effect on the prayer of the priest, perhaps even more so than the faithful in the pews. But beginning with the priest and deacons, religious educators, school teachers, parish ministers, youth ministers, and all the faithful, we've tried to reach them, and the process is not quite finished yet, even though we have only a few weeks. But it's an ongoing process of trying to remind people that the changes are coming, to explain why the changes are taking place, and to alert them to it. So when they do come to Mass after the changes, they will be well prepared for it. It will mean some challenge, I think, for Catholics, and perhaps some inconvenience, but it's also a blessed opportunity for us to think about what we pray, to think about what we say. Our familiarity with the text of the Mass over 30 years or so, I think, has also led to a certain complacency about the prayers of the Mass. And that's a very human factor. But the use of new words, a new language, will give us an opportunity to think about what we are saying and what those words mean. So even though the words themselves will be changing, it's also a great catechetical opportunity for us to think about and what we're saying and praying, and perhaps renew our own understanding of the liturgy and what takes place at Holy Mass. So it is a two-edged sword. There will be moments of challenge, and as I've often said in my diocese, we need to keep a lot of patience and even a sense of humor about some of the things that will be happening, and to do so with good grace. But it's also an opportunity for us to renew our commitment to the liturgy and all that it means for us. The liturgy is the heart and soul of our Catholic faith. It's the source and the summit of everything we do. So it's important we celebrate the Mass as beautifully and as prayerfully as possible.
Very simply, why change the English translation of the Roman Missal?
Well, as has been pointed out, the translation we've been using for two generations now, I suppose, was never meant to be permanent. It was meant to be a temporary translation until a better translation could be developed. And it has taken many, many years. This did not come about overnight. But even in the American Bishops' Conference, this was a result of a great deal of study and consultation. The reasons, I think, are to make the English language, and it's not just for the United States, it's for other countries, of course, as well, but to make the English language more in conformity with the Latin text so that there would be that sense of a unity and uniformity in the celebration of the liturgy, to make the English more consistent with the Latin text, but also hopefully to raise the level of our language. Sometimes the previous translations have been rather pedestrian, very common. I think some of the new translations are a little bit more inspired, a little bit more exalted, to remind ourselves that our prayer, our language of the liturgy, should be different than our everyday common language. So I think they are the two basic reasons why we've embarked upon this very challenging and long consultation, changing the prayers of the Mass.
What are the main changes that the faithful can expect when they take a position in the pews in the church preparing to celebrate the Eucharistic sacrifice as of the first Sunday of Advent?
Well, some of the prayers, of course, will not be changed. So I don't want people to be alarmed to think it's going to be completely different. The Mass itself remains the same, and many of the prayers will be very, very comfortable and familiar with people. But some of these specific changes they will encounter, for example, when the priest says, "The Lord be with you," the response will no longer be, "And also with you." Now the new response will be, "And with your spirit." I think that is going to be one of the most tangible and obvious changes. But other changes as well in the text of the Gloria, for example, and the profession of faith, and some of the other dialogues that take place during the Mass. The people will notice those changes immediately, because if they use their previous translation, they will be out of touch with what everyone else is saying. So some of those dialogues change a great deal. As I mentioned before, the changes will affect the priest even more, because the missal, the sacramentary, is changed. There are different layouts and different tabs and different texts, and so the priest will have to get used to the new missal as well. So we too, as priests and bishops, will have to practice, I think, a little bit with the new missal so that it becomes comfortable for us.
Everyone learning together, basically.
Yes, and that's why I think this process of perspective and patience and an even sense of humor, I think, is terribly important. We'll be fine. It will take some time for us to get used to it, but if we can approach it that way and see the new translations as a gift, as an opportunity, I think we'll get through this very well, and we'll be fine, and in a year or so, perhaps we'll wonder what all the fuss was about.
And thanks there to Bishop Thomas Tobin of Providence, Rhode Island. He calls himself the Miracle Man, but good science and a lot of good luck may have had more to do with his recovery from leukemia than a true miracle.
A man touched by God and by miracles in more than one.
Stephen Sprague was diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia back in 1995. Doctors tried everything to cure him, including months of chemotherapy. He was on a waiting list for a bone marrow transplant when his disease took a turn for the worse. An only child with no siblings, there were no donors available, and none in the registries matched his type.
I was diagnosed with a chronic kind of leukemia, which they told me, you know, you've got 3 or 4 or 5 years before you really have to start to worry. So I said, okay, I can deal with that. A year and a half after diagnosis, I went from the first stage to the blast crisis stage, the end stage of this process. It took them 6 weeks to get me into remission, and in those 6 weeks, they conducted a bone marrow search. That's all there was. That was the only option for transplant in 1997. In other words,
to find a donor who would give his bone marrow.
Yes, a live donor who would come and give up his bone marrow for a stranger. And the registry wasn't very big back then, a couple of million maybe. But, you know, you think that somebody's got to be a match for you. This is a big country. But HLA matching, I've learned, HLA is like a fingerprint. And no two are alike. You can get close, but if you have a large mismatch, then the transplant will not be a success.
HLA stands for?
Human leukocyte antigens. And everybody has its own set, and they're different for every person.
And I understand that even within families, even siblings or parents don't necessarily share all of these certain characteristics that are necessary.
Right. Siblings probably have a 30% chance of matching. I was an only child, so, you know, that took care of that. And then there's often or sometimes matches within the family. But you're still left with probably half the patients that need transplant have no related match, so they have to look for an unrelated match. Mm-hmm. The needle in the haystack.
But as Stephen's luck would have it, an unknown woman in New York decided to donate her baby's umbilical cord after birth.
She was at a hospital that had a cord blood collection program. And I'm sure they asked her, would you be willing to donate? Obviously, she said yes. She, to this day, has no idea what she's done. Part of the donation process is that the mother and child remain anonymous.
Because of the anonymous donation process, that woman will never know that thanks to her, Stephen Sprague was completely cured of leukemia and was alive 14 years later to tell his story to participants at a November 2011 conference in the Vatican on the therapeutic potential of adult stem cells. That's where I met him.
You said that you received this treatment back in 1997.
Right.
That was the year my son was born.
Really?
And I have to say, I didn't even really know about placenta or the cord blood.
No mothers did. It was, you know, this was in the early, early days when only a few mothers, and they had to be in the right city to be able to even do what somebody asked them if they would do. You know, mothers get asked, would you mind if we didn't throw this away and we stored it for used by anybody that needed it. What mother would say no?
Well, that mother's yes meant Stephen was able to see his kids grow up, marry, and have kids of their own. That mother's donation of cord blood ended up in the laboratories of Dr. Andrew Pecora and his team of researchers at Hackensack University Medical Center in New Jersey, where they were conducting the first clinical trials using cord blood as an alternative source of stem cells to bone marrow. By the fall of 1997, Stephen had been told to get his affairs in order. He had only weeks to live. But again, as luck would have it, he was given his last chance to enroll in Dr. Pecora's clinical trial.
Yes, that's correct. So my background is I'm a bone marrow transplant doctor by training. I'm an oncologist and hematologist, and I treat people with cancer, including leukemia. And Mr. Stephen Sprague, who's now actually world famous because of his life experience, He had a form of leukemia that there was no cure for other than a bone marrow transplant. Unfortunately for him, he was a very large man at the time, and he didn't have a brother or sister. He was an only child. And when we did a donor search through the unrelated donor registry, there were no matches. The only match we could find was an umbilical cord blood, but there were not enough cells in it for a man of Mr. Sprague's size. So we were very fortunate in that we were doing an experimental trial where we were using a new device that hadn't been proven, where we took cord blood, expanded it in a device outside of the body for 14 days, and that grew up enough cells from that umbilical cord blood that we then went forward with the transplant with Mr. Sprague, and the rest is history.
But so few patients can actually get into a trial like that. And he was so grateful to you that you didn't give up on him because he presented so many challenges. He had diabetes, he had a cardiac condition, he was overweight. But so what do you have to turn so many people away from these kinds of experiments?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think it's a matter of the center. I'm very fortunate. I work at the John Thorah Cancer Center in Hackensack, New Jersey. We're a very progressive place. We're a place of innovation. And there are many places like that around the globe where people can seek out this kind of care. To Mr. Sprague's credit, when he was told to go home and put his affairs in order, he was not ready to do that. He had a daughter that he was raising, and he sought us out. So there are places in the world, and I would advise any patient faced with that situation to continue to always explore all of your options.
The state of transplantation at that point was that if you couldn't find the match as a doctor, you watched your patient die. So there were a certain number of doctors that was not satisfactory. So they started looking at cord blood as a way to find an alternative source of stem cells. But the results in the early days were dismal. So the industry, you know, expecting better results, was not supportive of this new way to transplant a patient. So it took 5 years of dedication from a handful of doctors, several who are here today, to be determined to find an alternative to bone marrow, because they didn't want to watch their patients, just have no other option.
And of course, you've been following the research in this field today. What gives you hope for the future?
Well, we know that adult stem cells work. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about embryonic stem cells. They are not in patient application. It's never been tried. It's quite far away from ever being used, and a lot of speculation as to whether it will ever work at all. So here you've got adult stem cells, which have been proven to work for 20 years now. You know, so we're on the cutting edge. For adult stem cell applications, we've already seen 20 years, 12 years of progress. The new applications for stem cells, adult stem cells, is just amazing. You know, it's not going to be surgery. It's going to be stem cell applications to regrow diseased limbs, to deal with diabetes, to deal with heart problems, to deal with all of those diseases that are so horrific.
You have a vademecum of ideas for the future, where all of this should go. What needs to be done in order to make this kind of adult stem cell treatment available in all kinds of health fields for more and more people? How do you think that society, governments, doctors need to tackle this problem?
It's gotten much better. There's probably no transplant center that cannot do a cord blood transplant. There's not enough inventory to match every patient that needs a stem cell transplant. So first of all, the inventory has to be increased. More mothers have to donate. More average citizens need to become bone marrow donors. It costs nothing to be a bone marrow donor. It costs a lot to collect a donated cord blood unit and put it in the freezer. The patient doesn't pay. The mother doesn't pay. The people that pay are the cord blood banks that are working to build a public inventory. They only get recovery when one of their collected units gets selected for transplant. Then they get a recovery from insurance. So we have successfully convinced the government to fund...
The United States government
to fund public cord blood banking. Not a lot of money, $15 million, and it was renewed again after 5 years. So we've got the government engaged in trying to help the financial costs of donating cord blood, but it's nowhere near adequate. So we need the government to find more money. We need to find cost-efficient ways to collect and store. And, you know, the mothers are convinced that they are willing to do this. So that used to be the problem. That's no longer the problem.
You said another thing today, that you could be recognized by this badge you're wearing.
Yes.
The adult stem cells saved my life.
You know, when you're a parent, you watch for your children to grow and marry and family, grandkids. When someone says to you, you're never going to see that. So, you know, prepare. And then all of a sudden, you get it all back. And you see both children marry well to a son-in-law and a daughter-in-law who I like. And you start to see grandchildren. I had my fifth just last year. And, you know, when you are able to give in the gift to watch all this, it is, it's hard to describe.
You were sort of given another lease on life.
Yeah,
another,
absolutely.
And gave you a new perspective, a new way of looking at life.
Well, you know, I was a busy labor union executive. I thought I had an important job, you know, working for the rights of professional musicians to earn a decent livelihood. And I did that for 20 years. I did it in Times Square. I put in 80 hours a week, and I thought I had an important job. I never went back. So when you realize what is important and what true meaning of life is all about, then you decide that you're going to try to be an advocate for the next patient that is going down the path that you went down and try to make it a little easier for them. There were no people like that when I was transplanted. So it is a rewarding day, every day.
What do you think about this Vatican-sponsored conference here?
I've never been to the Vatican. I'm not a Catholic. But first of all, to see the city, the Vatican City, and to see how Catholicism operates, and then to know you have the power of the Pope behind something that really makes a difference to life. It's rewarding. It's encouraging. It's what we need. What the patient community needs is somebody to care about them. They have the medical community. They have the family support. Now they need the religious support to support something that will really have an impact on their life and the life. You know, this is a family disease, so it touches everybody in the family. And that would make a big difference in the quality of life of regular, normal people who get diagnosed with no warning.
Today, Dr. Andrew Pecora is Chief Medical Officer of NeoStem, a U.S.-based biotech company that has partnered with the Pontifical Council for Culture in the promotion of research into adult stem cells. His own research has taken him now into the realm of stem cell treatment for cardiac patients.
There is a significant percentage of people who have heart attacks that are large enough that it doesn't kill them, but it hurts their hearts enough that for the rest of their life, their hearts are going to be a problem. We have developed a stem cell therapy that looks like, out of phase one, now we're going into phase two, that looks like it's able to prevent the heart from being damaged over time from a big heart attack, and we're pretty excited about it.
Where are you sourcing these adult stem cells from?
So they actually come from the bone marrow of the patient who had the heart attack. People who have heart attacks go to their local emergency rooms wherever they are in the world. The standard of care is to open up the blocked artery. Once the blocked artery is opened up, in some countries stents are placed and others not, patients are put on medicines and sent home. About 4 to 5 days after the heart attack, we take patients to a procedure where we take some bone marrow from their hip. It takes about 20 minutes. They don't go to the operating room. They're wide awake. And we send those cells to a laboratory where we pull out a unique cell type that's able, once reinfused in the person's body, to regenerate blood vessels in the area of damaged heart tissue. And the way we give the cells is a cardiologist will place the cells in the coronary artery where the heart attack was caused. The cells are infused. Some 10 to 20 days later, you start to see new blood vessel growth, and 6 months later, the heart is working better instead of getting worse over time, which would otherwise be the case.
And how many patients have been treated with this so far?
Around the world, over 1,000. In our very important trial that we did, where we took a large patient experience and then developed it like a drug, where we were very careful about identifying this cell and the number, we treated 30 patients. And we've just launched a trial in the United States that has started now, where we're going to treat 160 patients.
And when will this study conclude?
It'll take about a year and a half. It's about a year to get all the patients onto the study, and then you have to wait 6 months to see if it worked or not.
Trials like Dr. Pecora's are going on the world over. Researchers using adult stem cells say they have successfully treated vascular disorders in patients who otherwise would have had a leg or an arm amputated. They've successfully regenerated skin tissue that refuses to heal, to treat autoimmune diseases, and even regrow entire organs.
We've been giving stem cells to people for over 50 years in the context of blood and marrow stem cell transplant. Every year around the world, close to 20 to 25,000 people get stem cells infused in their bodies to treat otherwise incurable diseases. Over the last 5 to 7 years, there's been an explosion, first in the knowledge and then in the application, of cells that are either from our own body or from somebody else's. Infused into body parts that are dysfunctioning. So one area is ischemia, where your blood vessels are closing down, either because you're old, you were a smoker, you're a diabetic, or you're just unfortunate. Trauma, where you're in a battlefield or in an auto accident, heart attack, stroke, etc. Another big area is organ dysfunction, and we heard some exciting news where people who have bladders that are damaged from radiation, as an example, who had prostate cancer, they can now regrow bladders. There was a famous case in Europe where a person's trachea was regrown right in the laboratory. So we are entering a new era of medicine, and actually a new era for humanity, where we are going to transform the natural existence we have today of whatever the DNA says the number of years we're going to live, that's no longer going to be fixed. And in fact, I see in the future people living longer and living longer and healthier by using cells to treat diseases.
And thanks there to Dr. Andrew Pecora, Chief Medical Officer of the biotech company NeoStem. And a warm thanks there also to Stephen Sprague, an advocate of adult stem cell research. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Laudator Jesus Christus.